Our visitor this morning is well qualified for his study of the presidency in general, as indicated by the titles of his books, Presidential Anecdotes, Presidential Campaigns, and finally, Presidential Wives. In other words, in the latter part of his career, he has concentrated on the study of the presidency and brings a vast knowledge to his subject. Paul Bowler was born and raised in almost on the northern border of the United States with Canada, and did his graduate work at Yale. Before the war, served in World War II, and came back to complete his work at Yale in history. He taught at Southern Methodist University, then at the University of Massachusetts, and then was the first person appointed to the LBJ chair at Texas Christian University. In that connection, he had a unique opportunity to know and learn about Mrs. Johnson as one of the presidential wives. I think the best testimony to his book is that not only Newcomb Hall, but B. Dalton in Phoenix, Arizona, features the book. A member of our family from Phoenix said at the breakfast table, "Oh, is that the Paul Bowler?" So, in contrast to many scholarly treatises, this work has attracted the attention of a great many people. It is, in my opinion, the most authoritative and scholarly work on presidential wives. And it grows out of a background that I might mention in conclusion. Paul is through most of his career, an intellectual historian, a theorist who looks for ideas, principles, broad trends. But he also is an empirical historian who studies hard the facts and the substance of history. And that combination, I think, is bound to make our discussion this morning very interesting and rewarding for all of us. And I only wish we had about 10 hours for this discussion, because his insights and knowledge are so extensive that I know we'll all benefit from the discussion.
Well, thank you very, very much. It's really a privilege and a pleasure to be here, and I'm so happy that Dr. Thompson invited me to come. I always like to get back in Jefferson country anyway, and to do it this way is particularly nice for me. I want to begin by saying something about a review I read in the Washington Post yesterday. Some of you may have seen it. Liz Carpenter reviewed the first biography of Barbara Bush. And if you read it, you'll notice that she was rather critical of Barbara Bush because she says Mrs. Bush doesn't express herself on public issues. She won't say what she thinks about ERA or abortion and so on. And this kind of amused me, because traditionally it would have been considered appalling if a first lady had spoken out on public issues. So I want to go back to the beginning of all this. And I think I ought to begin with a Thomas Jefferson quote. He once said, "The tender breasts of the ladies were not formed for political convulsions." Now, when he said that, he wasn't saying anything unusual. This was a conventional view. This was the conventional wisdom of Jefferson's day. In Jefferson's day, it was considered was taken for granted, in fact, that there were two distinct spheres of activity, the woman's and the man's. This was called the two spheres theory of the sexes. The woman's sphere, of course, was the domestic sphere. The woman was to be a good wife, a good mother, and also a moral influence. It was always considered that women were a little more moral than men. And then, of course, the male sphere of activity was the great outside world. He worked there. He was the provider. He brought home the bacon. He was active in the professions. And he was active in politics. And this two spheres theory held that the sexes should never intrude into the opposite sphere of activity. So what I'm saying is Jefferson was simply restating that view when he said that women should not be interested in politics. Now, because, by the way, though, I think you're aware of the fact that this two spheres theory lasted many years beyond Jefferson's time. You know, around the turn of the century, Theodore Roosevelt's wife, Edith, said that a woman's name should appear in the paper only three times. You know, when she's born, when she gets married, and when she dies. By the way, I can go further, come down even closer to the present today. Bess Truman once said that she thought that the wife of a public official, her function in public was to sit beside her husband, keep quiet, and be sure her hat was on straight. And I don't doubt that this two spheres theory still is dominant in certain circles in this country. Now, because of this view of things, many of the early first ladies kept a very low profile. I had great difficulty finding out much about them because their name never appeared in magazines and newspapers. They were never interviewed. And unless they wrote letters that have survived or wrote their memoirs, we just simply know next to nothing about them. I call them, in this book, I call them invisible women. Let me give you a couple examples. Jane Pierce, for example. What do we know about her? Very, very little. Right after her husband's inauguration, she moved into the bedroom of the White House and stayed there for the next 4 years. She only went downstairs a couple of times. She hired a New Hampshire couple to run the White House. People referred to her as the shadow in the White House. Another example would be Eliza Johnson, Andrew Johnson's wife. She, too, spent most of her time in the White House bedroom. Now, she was an invalid. So she has some excuse. By the way, this is another thing. Now, I have to keep from going off on tangents, but I became fascinated while working on this book. How many middle-class wives were sickly? They had what was called delicate health. And that's an interesting subject all by itself. Health, you know, has a history. Everything has a history, including history itself. But I can't get off into that. But let me say that Eliza Johnson, she went downstairs to be hostess for public functions only twice. And she insisted on sitting, and as the people went by, she kept reminding them that she was an invalid, you see. So many of our first ladies we know very, very little about. But I don't want to give you an impression that they were all invisible. Some of them received a great deal of admiration for being very gracious hostesses. Now, it was perfectly all right for a first lady to be a hostess. You see, that was still in the domestic sphere of activity. And so several of our early first ladies shone as hostesses. Let me start with Martha Washington. I think you're all aware of the fact that both George and Martha Washington were very conscious of the fact that their behavior in the president's house might set precedence. So whatever they did, they thought about very, very carefully. They were both very conscientious about it. Martha seems to have decided that the best thing she could do as First Lady, she was called Lady Washington, by the way, that the best thing she could do was to be an amiable, pleasant, courteous, gracious hostess at her husband's side. And this worked out fine. I think you all know that Washington himself tended to be very reserved in public. It was a little on the austere side. People found him awesome. Even people who knew him well felt somewhat awesome, found him somewhat awesome. I mean, he just wasn't the kind you slap on the back or call George, you see. And so when people met him, they felt tongue-tied. And because they felt tongue-tied, then he felt tongue-tied. Their tongues were getting tied all over the place. But when Martha was there, things relaxed, you see. She was so comfortable, down to earth, so folksy, and so on. So I think she did a really fine job in humanizing the presidency when she was first lady. By the way, at evening receptions, she'd get up at some point and she'd say, she'd announce, "President always retires at 9, and I usually precede." Everybody knew. It was over. More famous, of course, as a hostess was Dolly Madison. I've got to say something about her. I wish I had time to spend a little time on her. She's a fascinating person. She was probably the most famous of all our first ladies when it came to being a White House hostess. And I find this fascinating because I think you all know she had a Quaker background. And the Quakers in those days emphasized plain and simple living, you see, not socializing. She also happened to like fine clothes, you see. How did this happen? Well, one reason I think is that although she had this strict Quaker background, she had a grandmother who was an Episcopalian. And her grandmother brought her up to like fine clothes and fine fashions. Let me say something then about her as a hostess. I find this fascinating. Dolly did not ever discuss politics in public. And she, you know, admitted freely she didn't know anything about it. She says, "I don't like politics, that's not a woman's realm," you see. But somehow or other, at White House receptions, she could charm the leading politicians of the day, people like Henry Clay. She even got John C. Calhoun smiling. She was I use the expression small talk, which kind of fascinates me. Someday I'd like to do a short, maybe light book on the subject of small talk. She was able to engage in small talk very wittily, very engagingly, without discussing public issues. They flocked around her to hear her handle this, and I'm fascinated by her facility. I wish I knew some of the things she said. Here, I don't want to get off on, I keep getting off on tangents, but another thing I want to say at this point is I was impressed by the fact that many of the first ladies, when they began, were very shy. They felt awkward in public. I'm not talking about just giving speeches in public, but meeting other people socially. Would you believe it that Eleanor Roosevelt was so shy that sometimes when she had to go to a party, she would think of the alphabet for something to talk about. A, apples. Okay, do you like apples? B, you know, something else. C, something. So that's one way, you know, to think of something to talk about. Well, anyway, Dolly never had that problem, but Dolly apparently just said interesting, vivacious things that charmed everybody. Then let me move on to the fact that she was also a fashion leader. She loved to try out new dresses, new shoes, and particularly new kinds of hats. And eventually she had an influence on fashion, not only in this country, but in Europe too. And here, I wish I had time to go into detail with the great competition, the great fight she really got into with the wife of the British minister, Andrew Mary. Mrs. Mary, well, both the Marys, sort of looked down on the upstart young American republic. They didn't feel that President Jefferson had treated them, you know, with the awe with which he was supposed to treat the representatives of the British government. And so Mrs. Mary just determined to show these crude Americans how a lady could dress. And so I came across this wonderful story about this fancy ball in Washington. Mrs. Mary outdid herself in her attire. She walked into the ballroom. Everybody looked admiringly her way. A few minutes later, in walked Dolly. And she had just a stunning new dress, and particularly the hat. It was coiled like a Turkish turban, and it had two ostrich feathers towering to the ceiling. This was her creation, you see. And when she walked in, the women all looked admiringly her way, and all the gentlemen started applauding. And of course, Mrs. Mary was furious. She left disliking this country even more than she had coming here. Well, so there you have it. Later on, of course, Jackie Kennedy was something of a fashion influence too. But Dolly was the first of our first ladies to have an influence on fashion. So you've had your invisible ladies, you've had your hostesses, you've had your fashion leaders, but now I want to get into a more important group. These were the partners. I think this was more important as a feature of the life of a first lady. Being a partner. Because you see, a woman who was a partner could discuss her husband's work with her, could talk about politics, give advice, but it was all done within the privacy of the family. To a certain extent, she could get away with it. Many of these first ladies who were true partners of the husbands were women with intelligence, wit, strong opinions. They were what you might call domestic feminists. They would never have dreamed of going public, you see, but within the privacy of the family, they were real assets to their husband when it came to sharing in his work. Now, the first example I think, of course, think of is Abigail Adams. Abigail and John Adams associated on an intellectual equality. Abigail is one of the most fascinating of all of our first ladies, I think, because she wrote so well. By the way, I think John Adams wrote well in his letters. And their correspondence is wonderful, as some of you, I think, are aware of. They were separated often. John was, you know, off on assignments, and the separation was rough on both of them. But posterity benefits because they wrote letters regularly, and we get to read those. And those of you who are familiar with this correspondence know that she discussed public issues with him. And if she didn't agree with him, she made this quite clear. Of course, one of the most famous of all the letters is the one she wrote him in the summer of 1776 when he was down in Philadelphia attending sessions of the Continental Congress. And she says, "I long to hear you've declared independence, and by the way, when you do, I hope you will remember the ladies, because if you don't, they're going to have a little rebellion of their own." And John wrote back, and he called her saucy. That was his favorite adjective for her. But they teased back and forth about this. But let me say this. Abigail Adams, from the 20th century point of view, probably didn't go too far in the direction of women's rights. She would never have dreamed of demanding the right to vote or hold public office. What Abigail Adams wanted was more educational opportunities for women. She didn't see why a woman couldn't take an interest in science. And when she was in London with her husband, when he was minister to Britain, she attended a series of courses on natural science. But she respected the two spheres theory too, though. She never would have made political statements in public. Once there was a debate in a town meeting in a little Massachusetts village, and some man got up in the course of the debate and quoted Mrs. Adams as believing having an opinion on some subject. When she heard about it, she was furious. She says, "What gentleman would quote a lady in public?" See, that's Abigail Adams, you see. I'll give you a couple other examples. The Polks, Sarah Polk, James K. Polk. They were partners. They worked together. They, when James K. Polk was president, and working on papers, messages, and so on. She was in the room with him, working right along with him, giving him advice, looking over his speeches, and so on. He accepted her work with him as indispensable. Now let me come rapidly down to more modern times. One of the most fascinating examples of partners for me is the case of Bess and Harry Truman. Now you all know that Bess Truman, when she was in the White House, tried to stay out of the limelight. She simply wanted to guard her privacy. I don't think she really enjoyed being First Lady. I think she was glad to leave the White House. You know, her predecessor, Eleanor Roosevelt, had initiated the habit of First Ladies having press conferences. Eleanor Roosevelt was the first of the president's wives to have regular press conferences with women reporters. And when Bess Truman became First Lady, the reporters expected her to continue this practice. So at first, Mrs. Truman scheduled a press conference, and then she canceled it. Well, the reporters kept at her, and she finally agreed to answer a series of questions in writing. So the reporters got together, and they concocted about 25 questions. And Mrs. Truman, you know, filled out her answers. Most of them are very brief. Yes. No. And most of them are no comment, you see. And yet, despite Mrs. Truman's insistence in staying out of the public eye, she did insist on being the partner of her husband. From the very beginning of Harry Truman's entry into politics, he was in the habit of talking his work over with Bess. And she came to expect this as a regular part of the marriage. Apparently they talked over every aspect of his work after he got into politics. We don't know exactly what kind of advice she gave him. It would be fascinating to know. But Harry Truman, many years later, claimed that Mrs. Truman was his chief advisor. He said he talked over everything with her, the Marshall Plan, the atom bomb, NATO, all of these things. And he said that she always gave excellent advice because she always had the good of the country foremost in her mind. Now, I was fascinated by the fact that after Truman became president, you remember, it happened suddenly upon Roosevelt's death in April 1945, he was overwhelmed with the magnitude of the responsibilities he faced. We were winding up the European War, the Japanese War was to last a few more months, the difficult period of post-war reconstruction was beginning, and Truman just admittedly found himself just swamped with work. And so the inevitable happened. He began to neglect Bess. This partnership began to fall apart. He stopped talking over his work with Bess. In fact, he stopped seeing her as much as he was accustomed to seeing, and it is no secret that this began to bother Mrs. Truman. She began to wonder what was she doing there with her husband. We know this is so because in July 1945, when Truman went to Potsdam for the Big Three meeting with Churchill and Stalin, by the way, he called her every day, and he wrote her a letter every day. But a note of apology begins to creep into his correspondence. He keeps reminding her of all the things he's got on his mind, all the things that are expected of a president of the United States in this difficult post-World War II period. Well, he got back to Washington, and apparently the neglect of Bess Truman continued. Now we get to December 1945. Mrs. Truman flew out to Independence for Christmas with her daughter Margaret. A couple days later, Harry Truman flew out to join them, and then came what I like to call the Great Confrontation. I can't tell you what happened, but all I know is that Mrs. Truman blistered him. She read him the riot act. She really told him off about this neglect. And a couple days later, Harry Truman flew back to Washington, and he was furious. He was blistering mad, and being Harry Truman, he sat down and wrote himself a letter. He wrote this letter just telling his wife off, and he mailed it special delivery to Independence. Then he had second thoughts. And he got on the phone, and he called up his daughter, Margaret. He said, I have just written your mother a special delivery letter. Would you please go down to the post office, get it when it arrives, and burn it? And Margaret Truman says she did that. So we will never know what was in that letter. But Harry then wrote another letter, and this letter does survive. He came off his high horse. And there's still a note of hurt. He's still somewhat sore at Bess, but he does come down off his high horse, and he begins to realize that he has been neglecting her. And he reminds her again of the terrific responsibilities, all the things he's got to do. I had to do 100 things today, 100 things I didn't want to do, and so on. But he also reminds her that her opinion is more important to him than that of anybody else in the world. And so finally, the partnership was resumed, and so far as I know, the Trumans lived happily ever after. In other words, you see, this partnership was important to certain of our first ladies, even though they never wanted to get into public limelight at all. Now, one final category, and then I want to open this up for questions and discussion. The activists. Some of our first ladies have been activists, and of course you all know who the first great activist was, Eleanor Roosevelt. And the one who, even today, I think remains the most activistic of all. Eleanor Roosevelt is a fascinating story, because I must remind you that Eleanor Roosevelt started out accepting the two spheres theory 100%. She never questioned it. She had no interest in politics, no interest in social issues. She felt that her function as Franklin Roosevelt's wife was to be a good wife and a good mother. She had very narrow social sympathies. You'd be amazed. She shared the prejudices of her class at that time when she was growing up. And she was a very shy person, too. And now, what was it that made her gradually into an activist? And I think you know one of the major answers, and that was her husband's illness. At the age of 39 in 1921, suddenly he got polio. He worked very hard to try to regain the use of his legs, tried all kinds of physical therapy, but he was never able to walk again without the help of braces and two canes and so on. His mother, as you know, wanted him to retire at Hyde Park and become a country gentleman. But Roosevelt wanted to continue his work in politics. There was only one way he could do it, and that was if Eleanor Roosevelt would help him become a partner. And Eleanor agreed to do this. And that meant that she had to learn about politics. One of Roosevelt's best friends, Lewis Howe, helped train Mrs. Roosevelt in politics. She had to learn to speak in public. It was an ordeal for her. And I guess she was terrible at first. In the middle of a sentence, she'd start giggling, you know, from nervousness. And yet, gradually, she developed a very fine style of public speaking. She studied up on politics, she met, associated with politicians, and she became gradually very knowledgeable in this field. She became eventually, when her husband returned to politics and began to hold public offices, she became her husband's eyes and ears. When he was governor of New York, he began to send her on tours of the state to study state facilities, to see if certain kinds of legislation was being implemented. She'd visit hospitals, prisons, schools, and so on, and then come back and report to him. And by the way, he trained her to be a good reporter. He would ask her very searching questions. And at first she realized that she hadn't, looked for the right things, but she gradually developed a very acute eye for these things. But here's something interesting about Eleanor Roosevelt. Not only did she become a partner of her husband, people began to talk about the Franklin and Eleanor team. Not only did she become a partner, but she developed a career of her own, too, because in the 1920s, women's magazines began to ask her to write for them. So she began to do articles for them. She found that she was quite good at this, and then she enjoyed doing it. She began to associate with other women reporters, and the next thing she knew, she was a journalist. She had a career as a journalist. This was something apart from her husband. She was very proud of that career. It was a kind of a fulfillment that she never dreamed that she would have. I was interested to find that right after Roosevelt was elected president for the first time, Some of Eleanor's friends found her weeping in the corner at one point. What are you weeping for? You should be celebrating his election. She was weeping because she thought she would have to give up her career as a journalist when she got into the White House. Well, as you know, she didn't. When she got into the White House, she continued her career as a writer. She continued to write for women's magazines, Ladies' Home Journal, McCall's, Cosmopolitan. She also began a newspaper column, a weekly column called My Day, and she also wrote the first volume of her autobiography, This Is My Story, which is a very well-written book. Even Alice Roosevelt Longworth thought it was pretty good. She didn't really like Eleanor much, but she said, I'm surprised, it's really good, isn't it? All right, so when she became First Lady, she continued to work as a journalist, but she also continued the partnership with her husband. She was in on all the major New Deal legislation. She discussed it with her husband and with her husband's advisors. She even came up with ideas of her own. One of them was, of course, the National Youth Administration. She was always interested in young people. This was a way to help young people put themselves through college by getting them part-time work as undergraduates. She was always coming across articles that would mention some issue that she thought her husband ought to take some interest in. She'd mark passages for, you know, put it by his bed for him to read before he went to sleep. She was always bringing people, springing them on her husband at dinner or lunch, somebody she thought he ought to meet who had an interesting angle on some public issue. So, as I say, she was one of the most activistic of all. Now, she was continued to be the eyes and ears of her husband. I think you all know that she traveled so much as First Lady, traveled around the country so much that there were a lot of, you know, jokes about it. She was liable to, you know, pop up in the West Virginia coal mine and urban slum. Who knew where Eleanor would show up? There's an amusing story that I must tell you about the time one morning she got up very early and went to Baltimore to visit a prison. This was during World War II, which was engaged in turning out war goods. Maury Maverick, congressman then, asked her to come up there to look this over. Well, Roosevelt got up and he tried to get in touch with her, couldn't find her. So he called her secretary and said, where is Mrs. Roosevelt? She said, well, she's in prison. He said, well, that's a why? One other thing she did. Somebody has said that Eleanor Roosevelt was also the conscience of her husband. She was able to get into areas of thought and activity that he was not able to politically. And of course, I refer to the civil rights issue. It wasn't a major issue in the late 30s, but some of you know that Congress was at that time considering an anti-lynching federal bill and an anti-poll tax bill, and Eleanor Roosevelt wanted very much for those pieces of legislation to be passed. And so she asked her husband, will it hurt you politically? You see, he depended on Southern Democrats for a support of his New Deal legislation. It was just a subject the president couldn't speak out on publicly in those days. So she asked, if I come out in favor of this kind of legislation, will this hurt you? And he said, Eleanor, do what you think is right. And if you know, I get any flack, I'll just say, I can't do a thing with my wife, you know? And so she did come out on these issues. And then there are a couple of other things that Eleanor did that I want to mention. You're all familiar, of course, with the fact that she championed the great Negro singer Marian Anderson, who was scheduled to speak at Constitutional Hall. It had to be Constitutional Hall because the crowd was going to be large, see. Well, it turned out that the Daughters of the American Revolution had a segregationist clause in their constitution, so they denied Marian Anderson the right to sing there. Now, this shocked Mrs. Roosevelt. She was a member of the Daughters of the American Revolution, and she prized her membership very highly. She was proud of the fact that her roots of her family were deep in American history, you see. So she thought about this very carefully, and for a long time before she decided she simply had to resign. So she did resign in protest and then helped arrange for Marian Anderson to sing elsewhere in Washington. And let me give you one other example. It doesn't seem like very much, but I still think for its period, it is a moving demonstration of Mrs. Roosevelt's social sympathies. In 1939, there was a conference in Birmingham, Alabama, to start a group known as the Southern Conference for Human Welfare. It was to be an interracial group. Eleanor Roosevelt was invited to attend, and she went down there. Well, of course, Birmingham was segregated in those days, and it was made quite clear that in the auditorium where the conference was being held, it had to be segregated. So when it opened, Mrs. Roosevelt sat on the side of the aisle with the whites. And the blacks, of course, were on the other side of the aisle. But as the conference began and the proceedings went along, she gradually, casually, almost casually and unobtrusively moved her seat into the aisle between the two races. It doesn't seem like much, but it was, I think, a stunning gesture. Well, I could go on with Mrs. Roosevelt endlessly, as I could with all the others, as a matter of fact. But let me stop at this point and say, I look upon Eleanor Roosevelt as a kind of a turning point in the history of first ladies. After Eleanor, the American public was more interested in the first ladies. They wanted to learn more about them. Reporters wanted to interview them. Even Bess Truman, who tried to turn the clock back, so to speak, tried to stay out of the public eye. When Harry Truman was running for president in 1948, she had to accompany him, you see, on that campaign trail. You all remember something about that, don't you? How he barnstormed across the country, made about 5 major addresses, and then he made little whistle stop speeches. You know, the train would stop in a little town, the crowd would gather, he'd come out on the rear platform, he'd blister the Republicans, you know, for a couple of minutes. Then he'd say, "How'd you like to meet the boss?" And bring Mrs. Truman out. "How'd you like to meet the boss's boss?" And then bring Margaret out. By the way, neither Mrs. Truman nor Margaret liked this very much. But the crowds loved it. And Mrs. Eisenhower, who succeeded Mrs. Truman, she again did not take an active part in politics. But she loved going out on the campaign trail with her husband. In fact, in 52, Ike made the last major train trip for a president on a campaign trail. And he too would appear on the rear platform of the train and give a little speech, and then at some point he said, "How'd you like to meet Mamie?" The crowds would all yell with delight, and she would come out, and she loved it. By the way, if they had a little quarrel beforehand, he'd say, "How would you like to meet Mrs. Eisenhower?" And so I could go on. Jackie Kennedy, who was entirely apolitical, had no interest in politics, but she was drawn into it almost inevitably, became famous as a hostess and a fashion leader, but also beside her husband on trips to Canada, France, you know, she went over in a big way. And the next thing JFK knew, he had a major asset in his wife. And she was one of the first to have a special project, you know, redoing the White House from a historical point of view. And then Lady Bird had her project. So let me just sum all this up. Today, I think we expect a lot more of the First Lady than was the case before Eleanor Roosevelt. We really expect them to give periodic interviews. We expect biography. Look at, here's a biography of Barbara Bush, once she's been First Lady, only a few months. You see, that would have been unthinkable in the old days. We expect them to be with their husbands on the campaign trail. We expect them to say things in public, but avoid saying the wrong thing, you know, to avoid making gaffes and so on. And we expect them to have a special project. Mrs. Bush's, of course, is literacy, among other things. In other words, we expect an awful lot of the First Lady. So it cannot be an easy job. I think it's become tougher and tougher. The staff of the First Lady, of course, has grown enormously. Edith Roosevelt had one person on her staff, a social secretary. She was the first to have a social secretary. Now I think the first lady's staff is 20 or 30 people. Some people think we ought to pay the first lady. But I forget which one of them said, I'm glad you don't, because then, you know, we have more freedom if we're not paid.
Ms. Clark
said that. Who said that? Mrs. Carnage.
She
yes,
said
right.
You.
Yes, right. Well, I'm going to stop at this point. I'd love to get some questions.
Felicia Rogan got us involved in this subject, so she should have the right to the first question.
We assume that you admire Eleanor Roosevelt as being the epitome of a presidential wife, that you spoke so long about her.
Right. I would not say that I think every, you know, other first ladies should be like her. No, I mean, I think each has to be herself and should develop, you know, her position according to her own interests and talents. That's what I'd say. I do happen to think that she was sort of unusual, not just as a first lady, but as a person. I think she's one of the great 20th century women, you see. But I don't know if I'm getting quite at your question, but I think she had to be herself. And I think Barbara Bush has got to be herself, and Rosalind Carter. In other words, I think there's no specifications for this, except maybe public opinion. And so they're really free to develop this in their own way. And I think that is what it should be.
Did you speak to any of the children of the living presidents, or did you do this all from letters?
Now, I didn't do any interviews or anything like that with the more recent first ladies. Actually, I think most of what they are willing to say about themselves appears in interviews and in articles about them. I've met only two first ladies. I met Lady Bird, and I met Rosalind Carter last year at the in Atlanta during the Democratic convention, and I talked to her about 5 minutes. The only daughter I've met is the younger Johnson daughter. This may interest you. I'm getting a little off the point, but you may find this kind of interesting. I went down for a writer's conference at the University of Texas. I went to Austin, and I had to speak in one section of it, but for lunch, there was a poetry session, and I was invited to sit in on it. Well, Johnson's daughter, Lucy, writes poetry. I don't know if you knew that. And there were other poets that read, and she read some of her poetry. But what interested me was, she said that when it came time to give birthday Christmas presents, parents, she couldn't think of anything to give them, so she read poetry for them. I talked to her, and I sat next to her, in fact, and the first question, I had recently published a book called Presidential Anecdotes. I had an essay on her father, LBJ, plus some stories, and the first thing she asked me was, what's your favorite story about my father?
You're going to tell us?
All right, I will. You know, I had to think quickly, and at one point, you know how imperious he was, and how hard he's a fascinating figure, whether you like him or not. There's nobody quite like him. He could be, you know, he could be just as kind and gentle and sentimental, but he could be rough and tough. And one day he walked into the office of one of his aides in the White House, and he looked at the top of the desk. It looked like Dr. Thompson's desk or my desk. And he looked at him, he said, I hope your mind isn't as cluttered as your desk. And he walked out and cleaned his desk up. A couple of days later, Johnson was in there and he saw, you know, this neat top of his desk. He says, well, I hope your mind isn't as vacant as yours.
You couldn't win with him.
And that was the first story I could think of, and I told it, and she sort of frowned and said anything. I don't know if she liked it or not. And the other daughter, Linda, I heard this story. I never met her. She was a history major, by the way, at the University of Texas. Somebody told me that they were in a bookstore. I think this was in Austin, Texas. And I saw her looking at my book, Presidential Anecdotes. I guess she was looking to see what I said about her father. All of a sudden, she slammed the book and walked away. So, again, I don't know what that meant. I always tried to be fair to all of these people, you see. Naturally, I couldn't help liking some better than others. And let me just continue my answer to you. I am sometimes asked which were my favorite first ladies, and of course, I would mention Eleanor Roosevelt. I would also mention Abigail Adams, Dolly Madison, Betty Ford. I liked Rosalind Carter. I felt very highly of. You see, so there's several, and they're all quite different from each other.
Betsy Rasmus, you earned the right to the second question if you want to. She electrified us on the sermon on public service the other day at Monticello.
I worry about the first lady's role. I really had great respect for Ms. Carter when she said she didn't think and this goes against my brain, some of my thoughts, but she does not think that a first lady of the governor's mansion, the university, or the White House should be paid mainly because she said it, that makes you're obligated to a lot that you might not want to do, and she thinks it's nicer to have the freedom, and I agree with that. I wonder, though, do you think in researching, should there be guidelines for a first lady? And also, this is sort of an extension of that, I wonder if in my lifetime, will ever see a first lady that would really get 100% back in respect from the cabinet and the Congress? Will it always, you made a comment a few minutes ago, you said, who was it, Truman, who said, oh, I can't do anything with my wife, my wife's it.
Yeah.
Well, that prevails so much. I mean, if a woman does speak out today, a man can always fall back on, oh, that's my wife and I don't have any control over her. That attitude's not going to change for a long time, is it?
You've asked a lot of interesting things. The first, should there be guidelines? Of course, for Martha Washington, there were no guidelines, and she had to improvise. I think later first ladies often read up on the earlier first ladies. By the way, Barbara Bush has a copy of this book, and I don't know if she's looked at it and so on. I have a feeling that she's going to be herself. That is, I don't think she's going to change radically to fit some preconceived image of what she thinks a first lady should do, but there are cases of where Elizabeth Monroe, for which says I'll return them, but I won't start them. You see, is this all right? Louisa Adams, who was of course John Quincy Adams was Secretary of State for Monroe, said, really, you'll have to do what you think. It has to be your own way. I think that should continue, and that's why I don't like the idea of guidelines. Now, the second part of your question having to do with criticism of first ladies, I think of a lot of things. I think of some first ladies that came under horrible criticism, unbelievable. Eleanor Roosevelt was one, of course. Mary Todd Lincoln was another. Just unbelievable. Of course, it was true of her husband, too, but some of the stuff I read, she became an issue in the 1864 campaign. Bad enough having Lincoln another 4 years, but if you get him, you're going to have her too. And then just the ridicule was heaped. And she was somebody who did not make public speeches. She didn't feel that women should vote or get involved in politics. You see what I'm saying? But even though she tried to put her best foot forward in public, nevertheless, she came under great hatred. Now, also, you were talking about flack from the press and from Congress. She can get flack from within the White House. You know, there's the West Wing and the East Wing. And the First Lady's staff, they're housed in the East Wing. And under the Nixon administration, there was great, great struggle going on between the West and the East Wing. And Mrs. Nixon felt this very keenly. She felt that the president's advisors were trying to put her down, you see, to shunt her aside.
because no respect or because of threats that they were scared she'd have more influence than they wanted them to have?
I think that's partly it. By the way, I think some of them, though, proceed on the assumption that what does she really know? What does she know about politics? See, in other words, this two spheres theory can linger.
They have no respect. They had no respect for her intelligence, though.
Right.
I mean, that's what, as you pointed out in the earlier president's wives, they were together. They may have talked only in the family quarters, but the presidents respected them and liked to talk. Now it's almost, it's a free-for-all. It is, I get the picture sometimes that the president's the property of America and the press, let's say, instead of to have any kind. That is a threat. It was a threat when the Carters. People were very ugly about Rosalynn Carter's influence, in that she could be compared to Mrs. Adams.
Now, we do have this problem, and that is the American voters elect the president. Mm-hmm. See, they don't elect the president's wife. And so where it seems like in the case of Edith Wilson, you know, when Woodrow Wilson had his stroke and was incapacitated for a few months, and where she had to screen papers and people for him, you know. Well, some people just wondered if the president's wife should have that much power. See, we didn't elect her. You see, that is the argument.
Mm-hmm.
of course, these activistic wives always deny that they make any decisions. You know, even Eleanor Roosevelt said this. In fact, I quote this in my chapter on her, in her the autobiographical volume she wrote in 1946 after her husband's death. She takes up this question that we're discussing, and she makes the point that she did talk things over with him, but she didn't always agree with him. And she said perhaps he would have preferred a wife who agreed with him more. She said, I never could do that. And that she said her work was ancillary to his work. And then she says this, and by the way, this is a chilling sentence, I think. She says, I was one of those who served his purposes. This is the greatest activistic of all. I was one of those who served his purposes. It's a chilling sentence in a way. I think here's the greatest activist of all, and she felt that she was subsidiary. Your question's good. It opens up all sorts of things. For example, in any profession, actually, the wife will discuss things. What influence does this have? It must have an influence. You see? How can you pinpoint it? How can you escape it? Do you see what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
If it's a partnership. I know that John Adams, now here is an example of a man, I think he accepted Abigail as an intellectual equal. I mean, he just, the idea that her opinions were not worth considering never entered his head. You see what I'm saying? And they disagreed, and they agreed to disagree. You know. they used to laugh about it. See? Couple times, by the way, she went around behind his back. When he was minister to Britain right after the war, she thought that it'd be a good idea to get a loan from Holland to the young American Republic. And Adams just didn't want to do that, see? So she got in touch with Jefferson because they were very good friends at that time. He was minister, you know, in Paris, and she said, can you put pressure on my husband about this and show him what a good idea this is? Jefferson did. So Adams got the Dutch loan. Then they later learned about it. And said, well, you'll be bragging about this the rest of your life, you know. So it's complicated. I can't answer you in simple language.
Yes, Ms. Victor Young.
Professor Bowling, I lived in Hyde Park, New York. Lived in Hyde Park, New York for quite a few years. And we used to see her in Hyde Park sometimes just coming around with the postmaster after Franklin Delano Roosevelt's death. No Secret Service at all. And she was always very gracious and charming with stop and talk to people. But over her lifetime of marriage, she had a real cross to bear. And that was Sarah Delano Roosevelt. I was wondering, did you find any information that was affecting her personnel?
Oh, that was very rough on her. It really was, because she would try to exercise certain discipline with her kids, and then her mother-in-law would just go around her, do something opposite. She's trying to punish them. Sarah Roosevelt would negate that. Her mother-in-law, see, it was hard for her really to handle those kids, and she felt that her mother-in-law was making all the major decisions in the family. It was very rough on her. She was still this quiet, retiring type, you see. She didn't assert herself. So I think that was hard on her. Now, I've got to tell you, one of the episodes that led to her Declaration of Independence was her discovery during World War I, when her husband, when Franklin Roosevelt, was Assistant Secretary of the Navy. She found that he had was having an affair with her secretary, Lucy Mercer, young woman. She discovered that. Roosevelt was sick for a while, and she went to his office to fill in for him, and she discovered some love letters. And this came as a horrible shock to her. And there was a confrontation, and she offered him a divorce. But in those days, a divorce would have killed his political career. And so they agreed to stay together, and he promised never to see Lucy Mercer again. But I noticed that after that, Eleanor began to assert herself more. You see, somehow or other, she began to come out of her shell. It's interesting how that, now maybe she would have anyway, but I think this was the thing that led her to do that, and to assert herself in opposition to her mother-in-law.
Well, she had a small home of her own, about a mile east of Hyde Park. It's still there, now it's a museum.
Right.
And that's where, that was sort of an escape for her to go there.
Yeah, right. A couple other things when I think of it. You know, Eleanor Roosevelt was criticized for getting so involved in public affairs, and I said, why doesn't she spend time in her family? Yeah, but the thing that interested me was Eleanor Roosevelt was very conscientious as a mother. Nothing happened with her kids. You know, an automobile accident, a marriage, a baby, she would fly immediately. She'd drop whatever she was doing to be there. You cannot say that she neglected her family. She was very conscientious about that.
General Disney.
Since as a partner or an activist, when, if they get to the White House, or when, of course, would have a great deal of influence, you would think, and then they get a great deal of attention by the press. Wouldn't you expect then that there'd be consideration in a candidacy as to who was their wife, and would she be suitable? So far as I know, that is in the campaign, that really never comes up. Then they get a lot of attention after it.
I think this is kind of interesting to me. I can't do much more than just point our attention to it. But when James Madison would be running for Congress, Dolley would go with him. And some people said her being there helped him. And when he ran against Charles Cotesworth Pinckney in 1808 for the presidency, after Pinckney lost, he said, well, I didn't just have to face Mr. Madison, I had to face Mr. and Mrs. Madison. You know, in other words, even then, a president's wife seemed to make some difference. In more recent times, I'm interested in the fact that when Richard Nixon ran in 1960 and then later in 1968, at first, Nixon's advisors were inclined to write off Pat Nixon, and then they began to find, she was a very gracious person, that she was a real asset. And so they began to work her into the campaign. In other words, I think in more recent years, consideration by campaign managers, consideration of the First Lady's role during a campaign has become important. That's developed.
Next question. Treva Cromwell, and then please.
When was the first time that the term First Lady was applied?
Zachary Taylor, as president, is supposed to have used the term, and he was referring to Dolley Madison. You know, she'd come back to Washington at the death of her
husband, and he used that expression in an address he made, praising her. But it didn't become common, and then in the 1870s, a woman reporter used this term, First Lady, to apply to Lucy Hayes. That is the wife of Rutherford B. Hayes, Lemonade Lucy, they called her. But it didn't become common until, I'd say, the 20th century. Some people don't think it's a very good expression. Historian Arthur Schlesinger Jr. just thinks it's a ridiculous term. But it's with us, it's here, you know, and what I can't think of an alternative toward it.
Next question. Yes.
Do you think it might just be the nature of the office that has made it more sensible for the mate? If we had a woman president, we don't really want to hear a lot of the political views of her husband. In the case of Mrs. Thatcher, Dennis is interesting, and that's it. Elizabeth of England was careful not to marry. Victoria guarded that red box.
Yeah.
I don't think it is just the two fears of a woman. I think had we a tradition of women in politics at a very high level, the husband would also have had to keep pretty quiet and talk about cars. Don't you think maybe we've exaggerated the oppression of women at this point?
That's an interesting question. It makes me think of two. I've had this question raised. What's going to be like when we get the first woman president? I think we're going to have one someday. I don't know when. Gerry Ford a few years ago said in 20 years would be one. That made Betty very happy. But it doesn't look as though that's going to happen that soon. All right, then what will the husband do?
What, Dennis? Sure, yeah, does. Yeah, play golf?
That's right. Of course, he's retired. It's quite possible he'll keep on with whatever career he has. You're quite right about it. This country is not England, however.
Yeah, I wonder, is this unique to a democracy and middle class?
It could well be, but we always have our own little twists on things in this country, so I'm not sure it would be exactly like that. All I know is there's going to be an outpouring of press and television and radio interviews and so on to find out what the lady president's husband is going to be like. By the way, I think all of this has been affected by the outburst of, this intense... we live in a television age, this is what I'm trying to say, and we're just interviewing everybody, we're just... everybody who's in the public eye has to submit to this. I think this has affected the whole situation, too, don't you think?
Well, we were always obsessed by Fowler, remember? I mean, I think the people have always been curious about people in high office. I just was wondering about the suggestion that it is just women. I think it's, as you said, it's whoever is elected gets the final say.
But I would say, though, there was a period in the 19th century, though, for a woman, to get very active politically, she would, particularly if she were the president's wife, it would have been considered awful. Well, you know about Susan B. Anthony and those people. Mm-hmm. Susan B. Anthony decided to vote, in 1872. She voted for Grant because the Republican platform that year had a little mention of women in one of the planks. She says it's only a splinter, but it's something. So she supported him, and she said under the 14th Amendment, you can't deprive any person of life, liberty, or property, liberty, voting is a liberty. So she went and she convinced the registrar in Rochester, New York, that women could vote, and he registered her, and then she voted in the election and then was arrested. There was a trial. They sent a Supreme Court justice to Rochester to preside over the trial because the idea, if she got away with voting, what would happen?
What did happen?
So all I'm saying is I have to remind ourselves of that attitude. And Lucy Hayes, after the Civil War, women had been so active on both sides in war work. But when the war ended, there was a feeling that women were going to move into a new role in this country. People started talking about the new women.
And the women reporters began to look to Mrs. Hayes to lead this movement. And she absolutely refused to do so. She just stayed out of it completely. Because the pressures were still so strong.
Mrs. Yonke and then Professor Fernbach.
I'm interested in these albums, and it was, from what I understand, she was a wonderful hostess, a very outgoing person, and he was a morose man that most likely could never have been elected on his own, and so she was really responsible for him becoming elected, and after that she was completely ignored. I think she would have liked to be a partner in the marriage and the presidency, but she wasn't. She was denied that opportunity. Would you mind?
Yeah,
some of us couldn't hear who were.
Louisa Adams, wife of John.
Louisa Adams. I'm glad you brought her up, because I might even have a separate category. I've mentioned the hostesses and the invisible women and the fashion leaders and the activists. I might also mention one other category: the discontented, the neglected. And Louisa Adams would fit that perfectly. Now, let me say this and answer your question. She accepted the two spheres theory. She wanted to be a good wife and a good mother. She didn't want to, get involved in politics particularly. But she expected to play some sort of role of her own. She was a very intelligent, well-educated woman, and she faced nothing in the marriage at first except neglect. Not only did John Quincy Adams ignore her when it came to any major decisions, for example, if he got appointed to as minister to St. Petersburg, he'd just tell her casually one day, well, we're going to St. Petersburg. In those days, St. Petersburg, miles and miles away to this strange country. He'd also say, by the way, we're taking Charles, and we're putting the other two boys with some relatives. They were going to be separated, 3 or 4 years. And in other words, Adams even intruded into her sphere, made decisions about the family itself. Now, what I'm leading up to is, at one point, Louisa Adams sat down and started keeping a diary. And she entitled it The Adventures of a Nobody. This diary has never been published, but I was able to read it in the Massachusetts Historical Society, and you can see that she is seething with discontent. She wants to do the right thing, but she doesn't want to be a nobody, you see? And this was a theme I found with some of the first ladies, the quest for identity. I think Eleanor Roosevelt had that. Even Grace Coolidge did. Grace Coolidge, by the way, in a very interesting statement, said that, this she said after she left the White House, she said she didn't know who she was. As First Lady, she said, this was I, and yet this was not I. She says, who was it? Seemed as though her behavior as a white First Lady, she was simply assuming a persona that wasn't really her. You see, this quest for identity, and this was very strong in Louisa Adams. And I've got to say, I deal with that in my chapter on her, and I can't help being very sympathetic to her. I might say that things improved. The White House years were terrible. He was a failure politically, and he became, gloomier and gloomier, and apparently the White House was just like a prison, a dungeon. Both of them hated being there. And they got so they hardly spoke to each other. Well then, as you know, some years after he left the White House, some of his friends and neighbors asked him if he'd run for the House of Representatives, whether he'd consider this an indignity after being president. And he said, no public office in the service of the United States is an indignity. So he ran, he was elected, and that is where Louisa Adams became involved in the campaign, helped him get elected, and then after that, when he got into Congress, he began to share his work with her. I haven't got time to go into the reasons why, but there was a change. He began to accept her as a partner, she began to work with him on his congressional work, and the marriage improved. and she became much happier.
Professor Friend, I wonder whether, sir, we might not get some clue as to what the role of the male partner might be in a female presidency by looking at what's happened to the husbands of governors. We now have several women governors whose husbands must do something.
That's a good point.
And the other thing I wanted to ask was whether Mrs. Roosevelt didn't set something of a precedent in developing still further her career and public service when she became a widow.
That is, you're suggesting that as a widow, she was able to broaden her activities. She became a member of the United Nations. By the way, she taught school, too. I had forgotten that. I think that's, certainly I would agree with that. Your suggestions about the behavior of the husbands of the wives who are governors, that's very interesting. I can't fill in any details on that because I haven't explored that. Does anybody have any?
Yeah, the governor. What about Sandra Day O'Connell?
The governor of
Vermont.
You know
about Mr. O'Connell? Sandra Day O'Connell's husband?
Oh, yes.
What does he do?
That's a good question.
He's a lawyer.
He's a lawyer. I guess he's just continuing his practice.
Thanks, Lois.
I would suggest that the most activist woman governor in recent past was Ella Grasso in Connecticut. People remember her.
Yes.
And of course, she was a widow when she was elected governor of Connecticut. She, in effect, began a public career only after she became a widow, though her husband was not in public life. That was what she took up in widowhood as her cause of public service. And actually, most of the her personal eyes and ears during her one and a half terms as governor of Connecticut was her son. And I met him, actually, at another conference on another subject. And he performed for his mother something of the same role that Eleanor Roosevelt had performed. He went around the state taking notes on what was being done, what needed to be done, what initiatives. The only public notoriety I ever saw him have afterwards was that he conducted her funeral. Her funeral was a private one, even though she was the sitting governor when she died.
Very interesting. By the way, this isn't related to the questions, but it's kind of an interesting point. I detected at one point a certain amount of jealousy on Roosevelt's part of his wife as a journalist. Somebody was asking about her column. And so, that's not really writing. It's just a diary she keeps every day. You see, he was a little jealous of the fact that her column had gone over so much.
The thing that always has seemed to impress me about the second Roosevelt family is that if you look at other presidential marriages, there have been some wives who have been at least the intellectual equals of their husbands. Abigail Adams, I think, would be a case in point. Lucy Hayes, I think, would be another case.
Yes, I do too.
But there are, after all, only a few where you can speculate with reason, with evidence, printed evidence, the evidence of writing, the evidence of public speaking, that the wife was probably, all things taken equally, the intellectual superior of her husband. I think that is the case with Eleanor Roosevelt. That's my own opinion.
This leads me to an interesting side point here. One thing that impressed me was the fact that Lucy Hayes, whom you mentioned, was the first president's wife to have a college education. But the thing that impressed me, most of these wives went to what were called girls' schools. I haven't examined either the curriculum. These girls' schools were finishing school. But they got excellent education. Somebody like Judith Grant, for example. You read their letters, they're familiar with the classics. Mrs. Grant knew French, for example. The training they got. Do you know that Eleanor Roosevelt never went to college? A lot of people are surprised to learn that. She went to a girls' school in England, in London. But impressed me with the high degree of education, their knowledge of the classics, of literature, and so on, you see. And they brought a lot of this to their marriages. I mean, they educated their husbands entirely apart from the White House. They brought this learning
to them. So that's a very good point. They also some of them brought the economic advantages too.
Yes. If I can come back to a point you made earlier in my science in the room, you were talking about Louisa Johnson. And,
yes.
Of course, there have been first ladies who have brought social graces and economic benefits to their husbands in an earlier time. But there are, with the possible exception of Eleanor Roosevelt again, there haven't been very many first ladies who have come from a political background as strong or stronger than that of their husbands.
Their husband.
But I think perhaps one of the reasons for Louisa Catherine Johnson's dissatisfaction was the fact that she came from a politically powerful, wealthy, and extremely articulate family in Maryland, both her brother and a brother, an uncle, and a grandfather. At various times were governors of Maryland before John Quincy Adams ever became president.
Sure.
And that up until perhaps after the Civil War, the name Johnson was a powerful political name to conjure with in the state of Maryland. And she was of a political family at least as important in that state's affairs as the Adamses were in Massachusetts.
Sure.
And probably expected to be treated as a political ally, perhaps.
Right.
More than just as a subservient. At least inside her family.
Good point, yeah.
I'm glad we're into this area. It's so tempting to stumble into the unintended humor of the area, as when having heard such excellent statements by first couple of speakers, one is tempted, as one would with a male audience, to say, now that we've heard from the heavyweights in the audience, let's have some other questions. And I was on the verge of that until I knew what the consequences would be. But much more important than those little slips that we all are guilty of, if there is a deficit, and we tell one another regularly, there is of leadership in this country. Surely one place to explore the remedying of that deficit is in the whole area of the contribution of women. My father's family was 12. One was would have been elected if he hadn't died during the primary, the junior senator from Wisconsin. Two were judges, two were professors. But everyone in the family agreed that the most brilliant person in the family was a woman, who was a farmer's wife and who died at 55, who was up in the morning at 3 cooking for the threshers and also up at 11 washing the dishes. And somehow or another, in escaping this, we've come a long way perhaps, but we've got a long way still to come. And perhaps in addition to understanding the presidency, we may understand the American predicament if we look a little harder at this subject. And you've certainly helped us a lot.
Thank you.